26 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's on 31 and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist, and a Baptist, and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting in Canada, he's fighting in France, he's fighting in the USA. This way, and he's fighting for democracy or fighting for the red. He says it for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall. But without him, how would Hitler have condemned him at Dachau? Without him, in a war, and without him, all this killing can't go on. He's the universal soldier, and he really is to blame. His orders come from far away no more. They come from him and you and me. And brothers, can't you see? This is not the way we put an end.
Welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show. Recently, my wife and I watched an interesting movie called The Conspirator. It describes the failed defense of Mary Surratt, the lone female charged as a co-conspirator in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Her home, which she operated as a boarding house, had been the meeting place for a group who were seeking to kidnap the president. But that plot changed and spawned the actual murder. Mary's son, John, was apparently a good friend and supporter of John Wilkes Booth. Perhaps the most important aspect of the situation, as eloquently shown by Robert Redford's direction in the film, is that the military tribunals created by John Stanton, the Secretary of War, dispensed revenge rather than justice, riding roughshod over the rights of citizens, in fact, trying the civilians in a kangaroo court disguised as a military tribunal. Hey, doesn't that sound like something that's happening today? You know, Stanton and Andrew Johnson must have been disappointed when their setup, which violated the careful balance of power built into the Constitution, was thrown out after a few months. Too late for many of its victims, but in time for the rest of us, at least until recent presidents managed to get that horrible power back for the executive branch. It was definitely too late for Mary Surratt. In more current news, craziness continues to erupt in the Middle East as anti-American sentiments have surged. It's a pretty bad sign when the embassies get attacked. If it's really insulted Muslims protesting a disgusting video clip, well, the reaction seems a bit over the top, but it's understandable. It's their religion. If it's actually a, a false flag operation designed to drum up patriotic feelings before the election. Well, couldn't be much better timing, could it? I wonder if it's a prelude to a new or at least bigger war from our wonderful American corpocracy. I dream of a better America, but sometimes, this week, for instance, I despair of it actually coming to pass. All I want is for us all to live in peace together. I hope you'll all join me in that hope. And please, let's find a way to make it happen. Here's somebody else that used to dream of a better ride.
It's just a ride. And we can change it anytime we want. It's only a choice. No effort, no work, no job, no savings of money. A choice right now between fear and love. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
And now, coming to you live from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, in Duluth, Minnesota, Dreaming the New American Dream, with your hosts, Chuck Gregory and Mike Pelichek.
Thanks to Bill Hicks for those sentiments about a better ride for us. I'm Chuck Gregory. This is the New American Dream radio show. And I'm proud to introduce my friend and co-host, Mike Pelichek, an American writer.
Hello, Chuck. Tonight we're going to welcome Elias Barton. He's the author of Above the Universe Below and Haley Becker. Haley will discuss Fort Lauderdale city government, suppression of the homeless. And so tonight we're gathering together for the New American Dream radio show in Fort Lauderdale, Duluth, Washington, D.C., and you, wherever you are. Well, there are likely many ways to look at and analyze the recent attack on the United States consulate in Libya. There's something you can do to help you find out the truth about that. What I would advise would be to watch very closely what Barack Obama says happened and what NBC News says happened and National Public Radio, Fox News, the New York Times, and Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart say. Then at least you can eliminate that as a possibility. I'd like to plug a couple of websites here that I think are good and worthy of our attention. One would be Occupy.com. A lot of times we wonder, well, what's happening with the Occupy movement? And if you go to Occupy.com, you'll see that there's a lot happening. Another is Project Censored. Project Censored, just Google that. That's with, Peter Phillips, I think, is the director, or he was before. Another one is Kevin Barrett has a new article out on Veterans Today, or he's got two of them, actually. One is 9/11 Whistleblowers Upstage Assange, and another one, more recent one, is 9/11 Truth Takes New York. Kevin was in New York for the 9/11 anniversary, and he writes about that. Well, I just wanted to comment first quickly about something Chuck said last week about his decision to vote for Barack Obama because it's the best we can do at this present time. First, when I heard him, I thought, no, just don't vote. And then when he said he was not going to vote for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate, even though she's a much better choice, I thought, well, that's just not right. But now I understand, I think. Chuck's logic is much the same as the opinion voiced on our show a few weeks ago by Sam Smith, the editor of the Progressive Review. And what Sam said was that we should vote for Obama and then immediately, after Obama is elected, begin to fight Obama. And it's a strategy, and I think I understand now, and I think I also understand the angst associated with such a choice. It's a way to get a little better country, a way to defeat the monster Romney by using a different monster. But still, I'm either not going to vote at all or vote for Jill Stein, the Green Party candidate. And I just cannot escape the fact that Obama lied to us about so many things. Osama bin Laden for one, 9/11 for another, the crimes of the Bush White House, previous voter fraud, not going after universal health care, opening Alaska to the oil powers. And it just goes on and on, and it will go on and on unless we stop it. Bill Clinton's speech at the convention got lots of attention and praise, and you could easily come up with another laundry list of egregious crimes of Bill Clinton, actual crimes as well as just plain not being all he could have been and making us a far worse country than we might have been, and I think that's a big deal. Somebody needs to pay for that. So I cannot check Barack Obama's name because I think he's an agent of evil powers. I really do. How can I be for that? The drones, the wars, the not being the least bit interested in investigating the lies and crimes of the previous administration? Even if the other guy is also such an agent, something is wrong there. Somehow I have to find a way to oppose what is happening. But now, wait a minute here. Is not voting or voting for Jill Stein and having President Romney better than voting for Obama and in doing that getting rid of Mitt Romney? One really does have to do double and triple takes in thinking about this stuff. And do you ever really come up with a satisfactory conclusion? And is any of that voting stuff even a drop in the ocean next to folks like Deluce, Greg Borche, B-O-E-R-T-J-E, who is sitting in jail in Tennessee right now, awaiting trial for having sneaked into a U.S. military site and taken a hammer to the weapons? And are Greg's actions even comparable to the amazing, diligent work of Kevin Barrett in searching for the root of all this, the truth about what happened on September 11, 2001? All worthy of some semi-serious thought and then maybe a nap. Okay, then, the signs of the revolution will not be televised. Is this the revolution? From where will it come, if it comes? Is it coming from the recent plowshares action in Tennessee, the drone trial in Missouri? Maybe a great letter to the editor. A recent article says that violence has risen in Chicago due to increased poverty. Maybe that is where the revolution will begin, brought on by poverty. Maybe it has already begun. 100,000 march down the street in Washington, D.C. Some old guy refuses to stand for the national anthem at a Red Sox game. A lone man drags his grandfather's hunting rifle to the mountains of Idaho. My guess is that probably it comes from poverty and necessity and maybe some reading, learning. But where would the learning come from? Corporate TV? Probably the Internet. Some spark, some fire that just happens that was not quite planned but just seemed to work just right. Or probably it never happens. Well, not until it would get very bad and very evident. Lots of us are advocating investigation into U.S. history. I think that's pretty important. There's a lot to think about. All this thinking has put me in the mood for a beer and a nice early fall nap with the window open to the woods, listening for Bigfoot sneezes. But first, we must finish this radio show. Okay, then quickly onward. I also want to say something about why I think all the things I think about country and government like conspiracies. One is just because of being curious. I want to know the truth. I just have to know, even though knowing is so elusive. And so I read and read and read, and over the years, for one thing, after a while you've read quite a bit. Not sure if that translates to knowing, but it's a start, I suppose. The other thing, I guess, would be personal experience. The way to really know would be to be some sort of an insider, then you actually know. But for some reason, those people don't talk, don't tell the rest of us, and so we are, for the most part, relegated to trying to figure things out on our own. We look around, and from what we can see, the traffic runs orderly, and the birds are chirping, and there's milk in the fridge, so what's the big prob? Or maybe read and experience and just kind of figure something's not quite right, and you walk down your front steps and go try to figure it out. Or maybe you don't decide, but things just happen to you that make you wonder, and it kind of draws you in. Well, for me, I really don't know how I happened to be interested in things. It wasn't always so, that's for sure. I grew up in a small Midwestern town, small family, Catholic grade school. My father was an engineer for the Chicago Northwestern Railroad. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. Their house rent was $50 a month. This was the 50s and 60s. We came in from catching fireflies in the yard to watch Neil Armstrong tell us he was on the moon. We watched Martin King march to Selma, the Green Bay Packers win the first Super Bowl, John Kennedy's funeral parade, RFK lying on his back in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel, all on the little black and white TV in our living room. When my mom and dad took me to my first professional baseball game in Minneapolis, the thing I remember was the color of the Twins and Baltimore Orioles uniforms and the green grass. I guess I thought the game was played in black and white. I thought mostly everything was black and white growing up in the 50s and 60s in Norfolk, Nebraska. I played baseball, football, basketball, tried to run track, drank beer, rode the Main in my 56 Chevy station wagon black and white, and me and my friends would have no doubt gone to Vietnam without questioning because that's who we were. It was football season, you toss the football, baseball, you get up teams for a game in the park. War season, you go learn how to kill. Maybe get killed, but the war ended. I graduated about 283 out of a class of 287 in high school, went to junior college, flunked all my classes both semesters, then finally went to a nearby state college and graduated, then went on some sort of vision quest that involved a new cowboy hat, a dog, a 59 Chevy Impala, and a monastery in Oregon that wouldn't let me keep the dog. And then I somehow found my way to Minnesota and was like a whole new world, like I had landed on another planet. Minnesota was as different from Nebraska as the moon would have been to Neil Armstrong had he actually gone there. Everything was in full color, just like the new Walt Disney TV show, 6:30 p.m. every Sunday night. In the next few weeks, I'll tell you about meeting Dan Berrigan, going to prison, seeing Bigfoot, seeing a UFO, reading the Norfolk Daily News, and picking up an undercover, mind-controlled MK-Ultra hitchhiker in Iowa. Okay, enough for now from me. We need to get on to the rest of this radio show. Back to you, Chuck.
This PSA message brought to you by the DEA, the prison construction industry, and your local and federal politicians since who knows when. Thanks, Jesus. Thanks, Buddha. Thanks, Allah. Thanks, Alan the Alien, for the drug wars. How long has it been? Since Bush Sr. in the mid-80s? Since Reagan? And followed up faithfully by Clinton and more Bush, and really all your neighbors and church council members as well, huh? Locking human beings into cages for 10, 20, and 30 years, making their children cry their way into adulthood alone. That's us. We're everyone who ever worked to bring you the drug war. Hey, can we talk now? It wasn't about criminals. No, really. I'm not shitting. Dude, look at the bankers, all those who got us into war by lies, those who made money on killing. And look at the billions of dollars, alcohol industry. All that stuff's not illegal, but marijuana is. Natural growing plant. We made it illegal. Pretty cool, huh? Awesome, dude. So here's to you. Thank you for watching television and playing miniature golf and protecting the world from white-tailed deer. For all you do, this bud's for you. And this message, brought to you by your local county jail, gives your tired, huddled masses yearning to be free, and we'll lock them up. Put them in a small, dirty, old, crowded, out-of-the-way county jail. Tens of thousands of them throughout the United States. More than McDonald's. We do it our way. You got poor people or some who came from somewhere else. If they're stupid enough to think the Statue of Liberty holding up a torch, not a middle finger, well, send them to us. We'll teach them about America. We'll stick it to them our way. We're your local county jail. We're not the Holiday Inn. We're not Mother Teresa. And we're not a country club. This is jail, and we get paid to work here. We can buy beer at the good old Homeland Tavern on our way home with our money and try to forget. God bless America and your local county jail.
He's a cool dude who smokes and drinks on the sly and plays basketball with the other dudes, all in three-piece suits, and still they are so cool. Nobody knows where he's from, but they were so glad when he got here. Now they are wondering if he'll ever leave. He's one of those guys. His first job out of college was with the CIA. Do you ever leave the CIA? Just asking. He's complicit in the 9/11 attacks and bombing and killing and locking people away in prison forever. But when he talks to big groups, he talks like he's one of us, the best, brightest, hippest, coolest dude in the room. When he drinks beer, he doesn't always drink beer. But when he comes into my place and orders a beer, a tall, dark, cool beer, he also drinks Dos Equis, my spit, in my urine. He's the most powerful, hippest, coolest dude in the room. Stay thirsty, my friend. Now I'd like to welcome our first guest, Elias Barton. He is the author of Above the Universe Below. Elias Barton has lived on the edge of an active volcano. He worked in the Bible Factory and is the author of the novel Above the Universe Below. He was a semifinalist in both 2011 and 212 for the Amazon Breakthrough Novel Award. He currently resides in Washington, D.C. A little bit more on Elias. Elias Barton's art always stood out, even in his elementary school hallways. His creations weren't like the others. Raised in an ultra-conservative family that rejected the celebration of holidays, he was taught to avoid being a part of the world. When his class was tasked with a holiday art project, Barton had to adjust. Thus, a construction paper clown stood among paper pilgrims, a spider walked among Valentine hearts, a lone boy among classmates, a sole observer with a limitless imagination. Elias, are you there?
I am. Thank you for having me, Chuck.
Elias, this is Mike. Chuck is listening.
Mike.
Yeah.
All the better.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Yeah, very well. And congratulations on your work and attempting such a thing and having success. I think that's very cool.
I appreciate that a lot. It was quite a long road getting there and a road in which I had to make a lot of different decisions because the publishing world, as you well know, is in a lot of tumult right now.
Mm-hmm. How old are you?
I am 32.
When did you start on this path? When did you start writing?
Well, Mike, I've always been a writer. As you mentioned and read about in my early life, I would write stories in the class in which my classmates would write maybe a page, maybe two, and I would write, 15 pages. This was in elementary school, so very early on. And writing really helped me cope with a lot of the things I wasn't allowed to do as a child. And reading and writing, they were really my saving grace and allowed me to open up my mind, to think and to explore so that I could, I don't necessarily want to use the word escape, but I'll use it, escape from some of the very rigid belief systems that I was taught.
And is this Above the Universe book, is this your first one, or have you got others before that?
I've written other short stories, and I've written, quite a bit of my own personal writing, but this is my first complete novel. I'm currently writing a second novel. I'm about 80% done, and I'm hoping to have that ready sometime early next year.
The book is Above the Universe Below, and would you like to, either or, do you want to tell us a little bit about the book, or read a portion of it, or just get into it a little bit and tell us what the book is about?
Sure. We can do any and all of those things,
sure,
Mike.
Go ahead.
Above the Universe Below is about a man who is a loner. His name is Carter, who grew up in a very abusive household, and the question or the crux of the book is how art can help somebody survive those circumstances. And Carter actually travels to another world in which he helps the creatures of that world in their own passings from life to death. So in a weird sort of way, he's a Grim Reaper. And the only way that anyone could have any knowledge of this in our world is through the artwork that he does. And one day he meets someone who appreciates that art and becomes an advocate of that art. And really, it was inspired largely by an artist named Henry Darger, who was a lowly janitor, someone that society didn't pay much attention to. In actuality, this is was a real person. But they later discovered that he had reams and reams of artwork. And now his artwork is shown at the American Folk Art Museum in New York City. Of course, he has passed on, so he has no knowledge of this. But my angle was, what if someone had discovered him? And also, how many people in our lives have these interesting perspectives, and yet they're never discovered because we tend to discount them or society pays no attention?
Did you have somebody like that with you, too, that supported you in your quest to be a writer, that gave you confidence?
Honestly, I would say that anyone that I came into contact with growing up that had to do with the arts really did encourage me, Mike. And I really appreciate that, because these teachers are so important in our lives, in our children's lives. And it was really only through reading, writing, and people such as teachers that I got that encouragement. And so really I kind of credit the arts with kind of leading me to question everything and to educate myself, because my family was very, very strict in what they would allow, except for books. And that really is something I'm very thankful for, and except for teachers. And so I'm very thankful that I was allowed access to those people to kind of help me along in just those moments when I needed it the most.
Elias, do you have the book handy there? Could you read maybe half a page or so of something?
Sure, I can. I have a chapter 25 here, which is entitled Happiness Found with Multiple Stab Wounds. And it happens kind of after one of the main climaxes in the book, after a night at an art gallery, which I won't give too much away. I'll just go ahead and read it and let the writing speak for itself. They've become one creature. No longer Carter and Mandy, uncle and niece, male and female, adult and teen, nerd and sinner, straight and gay, freak and butterfly. Together, they're one, alone, disowned, the same shared soul spread between two bodies, winding down four flights of stairs like a snake coiling an escape. Everything that's happened to Carter has happened to her. And the rejection and grief staring at Mandy looks his way as well. Her tears well in his eyes, but Mandy no longer holds on to them, shedding them freely on the stairs they descend. Tears of anguish, of ecstasy, alternating, mixed. Neither knows to where they run. There's no need for navigation. All that matters is that they go jointly. Each walked an isolated path for so long that their combined experiences now surpass heartbreak. By the time they hit the street, they gulp in hilarity. They laugh like animals howl to the center of the universe in their stomachs. Their arms, emptied of the loved ones and imposed histories, stretch and reach moving freely. Extinguishment from the respect of those who purported to love them means there's no more loss to fuel the burning. Abandonment lets them proceed with abandon. They pass through Hell's Gate only to find an uncapped fire hydrant cooling its street on the other side. And that portion really touches on another major theme, Mike, in the book, which is finding unconditional love in our lives. Many of us have had families where maybe that wasn't possible, or the family was broken, fractured, maybe the adults had issues, whatever. We each have our own kind of version of that. But one of the things I wanted to highlight with the novel is that we each can stake out and find what it is we're looking for, which is family and unconditional love. We may just have to make it ourselves.
Elias, do you feel like explaining the title, or do you want people to figure that out on their own?
Well, there are a lot of possible meanings to the title and to a lot of other things in the book. But one of the things that I felt like the title alludes to, at least for me personally, is, well, there are several levels. But the more thematic level is the macro and the micro unification. And by what I mean by that is that everything is related. Every single thing that we do, no matter who you are, what you're doing, where you are, we all have to realize that we basically are in this together. So there's an actual saying called as above, so below. And that, you know, I kind of incorporated that into the title. There's another allusion that the title has, which is to the universe below, which for Carter occurred often when he was kept in the basement of his childhood home. And that is when he would travel to these other worlds throughout his entire life and actually become an escort to the creatures in those worlds.
Thank you very much for joining us tonight, Lass. And I, do you want to, or do you have any events or readings you want to tell us about that are upcoming?
I do have events coming up, and I think probably the best way for anyone to keep abreast of them is just to visit my website, which is www.eliasbarton.com. And I'll be updating that even this week with some of the other events that are going on.
Something else I want to ask is, did you self-publish, or did you find a publisher, or how did you get all that to happen for you?
Mike, that's actually a very interesting question because, as I said, it was a very long road getting to where I got. The publishing world, much like the music world and many other things having to do with the corporate world, is kind of a mess right now, which is going to come as no surprise to you or really to anyone who has knowledge about them. So what I found with this book, I did go to school for creative writing. I went to a school in New York City, which was very well regarded. I got a lot of fantastic feedback. And even with this book, I got great feedback from mentors as well as from agents who would help in the publishing process. But the interesting thing is that they actually want only highly commercial, what they consider to be highly commercial work. They're all looking, of course, you know, for the next J.K. Rowling, the next, you know, Twilight series, which means that a lot of the nuances of a lot of writing is going to disappear. So I kind of came to the decision eventually that I should publish this myself, that I could actually commit to bringing this book from, you know, from the draft. I edited it like crazy, and then to present it. And it has worked out really well, and it's cut, I would say, probably 5 to 7 years off of the publishing process by doing so.
Well, congratulations, Elias, really, for getting it all done. The book is Above the Universe Below. The author is Elias Barton. And tell us once more where people can go to find you and your book.
You can find me at www.eliasbarton.com.
Okay. Thank you very much, Elias, and have a good night.
Thank you so much, Mike.
Yep, bye-bye. Yep.
God bless the Grand Canyon. God bless Mount Rushmore, Grandpa and Grandma, and Mom and Dad, and Sally and Johnny. God bless the dead Iraqi kids, and the dead Afghanistan kids, and dead kids everywhere. God bless the Golden Gate Bridge, and the Empire State Building, and the Statue of Liberty. God bless Rover and Mr. Flopples and Dixie and Miss Thompson, too. And God bless our soldiers and troops and bombs and bullets and ships and really big bombs. And our president, too, lives in a big, big White House. I'm sure our president would kill anyone who could really keep him from staying in his big, big White House. So God bless me and God bless you, too.
Now it's time for The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog. We've heard all about the Russian space monkeys who went into outer space and didn't come back until the Soviet Union was gone. And when they did come back, they were expecting maybe a parade or a nice DACA out on Taiga View Lane, but that didn't happen. Well, the Americans had their own space dog program going, trying to match the Russians with similar results. When those dogs returned from having been sent up by President John F. Kennedy and splashing down after November 22, 1963, the world they returned to was barely recognizable with Lyndon Johnson in the White House. Some of those dogs took the option of shooting right back out to space. Some moved to Ukiah. Some lived on the streets for years and years, and one of those was Buzz. This past week, Buzz was watching the Democratic National Convention. Balloons, so many balloons. I love balloons, he said. And all that shouting. I've always loved shouting, he moaned, as he drew one paw over his eyes. And somewhere they showed a clip of the last presidential motorcade up to the inauguration ceremony. He thought, hey, where's my damn parade? It's that recurring thought he has, nostalgia, which can be brought on by almost anything. A beautiful sunset, water lapping at the shore, someone else's parade. So Buzz threw open his window, stuck his head out, caught himself by his back paws, and leaned all the way out. He yelled into the street, into the dark night of America, ruff, ruff, woof, ruff, woof, bark. Hey, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it for very much longer. How about you? He slammed down the window and walked around the sofa 3 times and sat down. He got curled up with a beer and some rawhide chips and clicked channels, but went right back to the convention coverage. He wiped an eye with his paw. He loves his country, Buzz does. He remembers all the glory days, all the other young pups, the parties, the training flights, the danger, pushing the envelope, the paddling around in the ocean, nights out, that little Cape Canaveral bitch. But there was also a good bit of boredom, loneliness on long flights, playing chase the ball with yourself for hours, trying to get Alpo out of the toothpaste tube, the in-flight movies, Rin Tin Tin, Lassie, Lost in Space, some joker that Tom was down in flight control. And then finally, when Buzz got back, it was like the whole country had changed. JFK, LBJ, Nixon, Carter, Reagan, Clinton, the Bushes, Obama. Geez, what next? Buzz shook his head, left the TV on, nosed open the sliding door to the deck. He slurped an old style from his dish and just lay on his back with his legs up, looking at the stars. To think he had been up there, it was like it was some other dog who had done that. Was it really him? Was he really up there? He nosed the bowl of pretzels off the table and picked one up in his mouth when it crashed to the floor. He jumped in the lounger and just looked around the quiet neighborhood at the last of the kids running inside from playing, so excited to be starting school. the blue glow of the televisions in each window, he looked back up at the sky. Nobody ever looks up anymore, he thought. Geez, just look at that. And to think I was, wow. He got up, noticed the sliding glass door closed, and slept outside the rest of the night. Join us again next week for more Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog, when we will hear Buzz wonder, WTF, to see a new mailman coming up the sidewalk wearing a sidearm. The Adventures of Buzz the Space Dog is sponsored by the Stanley Kubrick Estate, Rocks R Us Moon Rock Plastic Toys, and Under the Big Top Indoor Movie Lighting Systems.
Our second guest tonight, joining us from somewhere in Broward County, I think, the same place I am, is Haley Becker. Haley is an activist for Food Not Bombs, and she's going to talk to us about the longstanding persecution of homeless by the Fort Lauderdale City Fathers and the police. Haley, welcome to the New American Dream Radio Show.
Thanks. How are you all doing, Mike and Chuck?
Hi. We're doing pretty good.
Great.
So am I right that you're in the Fort Lauderdale area tonight?
Yeah, I'm in the Fort Lauderdale area tonight. Yes,
okay.
I am.
All right. You used to live here, right?
Yeah, I used to live in the Fort Lauderdale area. I'm from here, and I worked with Food Not Bombs for about 5 or 6 years, where we shared food in a public park in downtown. Currently, I live in New Mexico, but I'm visiting family for the time being and trying to organize around these cities' efforts to basically run the homeless out of sight, out of mind. I'm in Fort Lauderdale right now.
Okay. Well, let's see. I think yesterday or the day before there was some sort of a rally, wasn't there?
Right. On Tuesday, we had a the Food Not Bombs group shares food on Tuesdays now, and we decided to throw a bit of a festival party to try to reclaim Stranahan Park, which is a public park in the downtown Fort Lauderdale area. And when I say reclaim Stranahan Park, it's because although it's a public park, the city and the women's club have invested almost $300,000 in, as they would say, beautifying the park, but as a result have been discriminating against the homeless and brutally running them out of a public space. So we are attempting to reclaim our public spaces for public uses. And,
well, that's certainly a worthy cause. That area in front of the library has for years been a gathering place for homeless, for chess games or just hanging out, and I've always had the impression that it was a nice thing, a nice place for people to be,
right.
Not something that the city should be ashamed of.
Right. Actually, the location of the park is very convenient for those who are on the streets. It's right by the public library, so there's public access to internet, water, bathrooms, books. It's also very close to a lot of social services and resources for the homeless, as well as the public transportation. So it naturally kind of became this sort of area where a lot of homeless folk would go to get out of the to get shade and get out of the sun and rest their feet for a while and gather for community meals. Lots of groups, including Food Not Bombs, have for many, many years gone to this one park to share food and eat as a community. And it was a great place. But in
what exactly are the laws that they are trying to use to chase people out?
Right. So that's sort of the I wouldn't necessarily, for lack of better words, that's sort of the funny thing about it, is there are no laws. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate on that just a little bit?
Right. So for a quick background, about 2 years ago, the city put together a task force called the Homeless Task Force, made of city officials, some members from the police department, a couple of homeless advocates from church groups, along with the Chamber of Commerce. And their goal was to find an alternative fixed feeding location, as they would call it. And the purpose of this was, and I quote, the only way for the city to prevent people from sharing food in Stranahan Park is to have a fixed feeding location that is an alternative for volunteers to share food. And after trying that for about 2 years and continuously running into problems with folks saying, not in my backyard, we don't want a fixed feeding location in our area, they decided to resort to other methods of trying to push the homeless out of the downtown area. And that's where we are today, which would be a anti-panhandling ordinance that was recently passed in May, where those who panhandle are at risk of $500 fine and up to 60 days in jail.
Oh, naturally they can afford it if they're panhandling, right?
Yeah, right. Right. And then, along with that panhandling ordinance, the city of Fort Lauderdale spent $27,000 to $28,000 of taxpayer money for anti-panhandling propaganda, where you may run into signs on parking meters or around the city that display a hand with a cup and change going into it, and it's crossed out and it says don't contribute to the problem. And then on top of all of this, the Women's Club in the city invested $237,000 to turn the park into a botanical garden. And it looks great, but the purposes of the purpose of this money being invested and into putting plants in the park, and it's very clear when you're in the park, the plants take up the majority of the space where most folks used to take a nap or whatever it may have been, instead of get out of the shade. And since that money has been invested in the park, the police have unlawfully been enforcing and backing this money that the city and the Women's Club are pumping into that area of Fort Lauderdale by running homeless people out of the park and threatening with trespassing. But it's important to know that the Women's Club in the late 70s donated that park to public use, and once a park is donated for public use, it can only be used for public use. The city is not allowed to sell it back for any private use or anything like that. So basically what's going on is the police are discriminating and targeting homeless folk and threatening some of the most vulnerable people in our society, those who can't fight back, with more, you know, possible jail time and fines that they don't have the means to deal with. And now we have a beautiful park in downtown Fort Lauderdale that is empty, and the majority of people who used to spend their time in it are afraid to go into the park because of police harassment.
Well, that's just crazy.
But
typical of government thinking or police thinking, I'm afraid.
Right. You know, it's class war. You know, it's the money that's coming from the Women's Club. They have a lot of money and the city, and they're funneling it into an attempt to push out the homeless, and the police are just simply enforcing and backing all this money, and it's unlawful what they're doing.
Yeah. What can we do about it?
Well, right now, what Food Not Bombs in South Florida is trying to do is a couple of different things. We are not going to take it. We will use that public space for public use, and we're continuing every Tuesday at 5:30. We share food. We try to bring the community together. We play games, and we use the park for how it is supposed to be used. We are keeping track of the city commission meetings and any other possible ordinances that come up. But most of all, what we're trying to do is rally together our community and empower the homeless, the most vulnerable in our community who are being harassed, to empower them and give them the strength and the backing and the support that they need to stand up for their rights. And so that's what we're doing right now. We're trying to organize the community to join us every Tuesday for dinner and to talk to these people and really find out how to learn about how hard their life is, even if there wasn't police harassment, but with the police harassment on top, and try to be a community and figure out how we can, you know, stop the city from this harassment.
Not many of our listeners aren't in the Fort Lauderdale area, so
right.
They might want to help out in some other way. Can you tell them how to do that? Maybe how to make contributions to Food Not Bombs, or find out more about activities in other places.
Right, yeah. So Food Not Bombs is actually an international organization, and you can locate different chapters on foodnotbombs.net. But this is actually not something that is unique to Fort Lauderdale. This harassment is going on in cities all across the United States. Currently, there is a feeding ban, which prevents volunteers from coming out and having a picnic and sharing food with people in public spaces in Orlando. Just last June, there were 28 arrests for people who were simply sharing food with the homeless. And there's recently a feeding ban passed in Houston and Philadelphia, and dozens of other cities across the country are about to pass similar feeding ordinances. So I would say for those across the country, the best way to probably is locate maybe a Food Not Bombs chapter in your area, find out what's going on with them, contribute to, you know, it's potluck, bring some food, sit down with the community, but also keep track of what your city commission is the ordinances that they're passing and they're talking about. You know, there's all sorts of ways to email campaigns to, you know, just let the powers that be know that they are being watched, and that we are not, that we stand together as a community, and we are not going to take it. So yeah.
I think that you and Keith and others in Food Not Bombs who are really dedicated to this. Getting arrested at one of these rallies is almost a rite of passage.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But, well, for some of the rest of us who aren't willing to go quite that far, I'm still going to try to get down and chat with the people one of these Tuesdays.
Yeah, that'd be great.
I'm not in a position to contribute financially, but if any of our listeners are, it's a good cause.
Right. Yeah, we appreciate it. We appreciate every last bit of help, and also I'd like to note that folks shouldn't be worried about possible arrest. You know, what's going on is we're using public spaces the way the public wants to use it, and it's extremely unfortunate that our city government, that city governments across the country are persecuting people who are just trying to share food and help those in their community. And there's all sorts of ways to be involved without risk of arrest. So, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
Haley, thank you very much for being with us tonight. This has been very interesting and very informative. And I really liked the opportunity to talk about a local problem like this, even though it's one part of a national problem. This is something a little bit different for us on the show, and I really appreciate it.
Right. Well, I really appreciate you all having me.
All right. Thank you, Haley, and have a good night.
Yep, you too. Have a great one. Bye.
The fish is not aware of the water. The American is not aware of the TV,
yeah,
the propaganda, the lies. Russian menace. Patrice Lumumba must die. Jacobo Arbenz must die. The fish is not aware of the water. The American is not aware of the TV, the propaganda, the lies. Mosaddegh must go. El Salvador, Italian workers, peasants, Greek socialists, Nicaraguan peasants, Grenada, Philippines, Vietnam, Laos, Argentina. All threats to the American way of life, eating Doritos, watching TV in the dark with a cushy pillow. They're out there. They're dangerous. Workers, self-government, health care, roads. No police, no military. The fish is not aware of the water. The American is not aware of the TV, the propaganda, the lies.
The moon. We went there and never went back. Makes sense. The same thing happened with the big discovery of the car and the airplane in Hawaii and Las Vegas. And no problem in getting back from the surface of the moon to that main spaceship thing. And the technology? You mean we could do that in the 60s when computers were as big as rooms and there was no such thing as personal computers, the internet, and we never went back? And, hey, wait, let go of me. Hey, where's your warrant? There's a beverage here, man. I have my rights. I'm going to the library. I'm doing a paper. Freaking hall monitors, they think they own the stupid school. And that press conference, wow, Buzz Aldrin, Neil Armstrong, Michael Collins, they should have been like, man, we are so excited to just get back from the moon. We had never tested that moon landing thing and then the takeoff from the moon and the hookup with the orbiter thing, because how could you practice that? And it all worked like a charm, like I'm going to live, and I've been to like the moon, man. But they were like, we are so depressed and so shy. And did we see stars or not? Yes, no, yes, I don't know. It's like almost like they were hiding something. Hey, let go of me. I left my pants in my other pants. I told you, man. Goddamn fascists.
The mind of an American rules the world. The president? Warren Buffett? Tiger Woods? Katie Couric? John Stewart? Michelin Man? No, stupid, it's you. You're the king of the world. God, Superman, King Midas, all that, it's you. You're more than just a legend in your own mind. You're the man. When the CIA, through the CIA propaganda machine called Radio Free Europe or the American Free Press, tells you the Russians are coming or the criminals are coming or the terrorists or Iranians or Iraqis, Afghans on blue-powered, nuclear-powered donkeys, big bees, you believe it? Well then, Zeke, that's how the world will go. You're powerful. Most powerful yahoo who ever lived in the history of living, and you're an idiot. The world is going to burn. You're not an idiot on purpose. You're an idiot nonetheless. CIA. Persons in the CIA are smart, but they're evil. actual evil empire, and they control you. The most powerful person in the world, if you weren't an idiot, they couldn't do it. But you're an idiot. That's a bummer, man.
Well, it's been a long week in Mount Liberty, Nebraska, my hometown. Kate King is the daughter of Jack Robert King and Cherry King, and Johnny King was her brother. A while back, you might recall, you might not, that Jack Robert King took his online podcast radio show on the road. He rode a bus from Nebraska to Oregon. He said he was looking for Bigfoot. Maybe we'll find more about that story later. But he just wasn't going to Oregon to see if he could have a Bigfoot experience. He also wanted to find out the truth about America. He just felt in his gut that he didn't know the whole story, and he had to know. Well, he found out at least something, at least more than he knew before. And what we do know, that after he returned, well, a few weeks or months later, he and Cherry and Johnny were dead, and the radio show was no more. Little Kate saw the whole thing. She saw it all, and she ran. She ran into the corn that afternoon, and she lived, and she suffered, and she survived, and she learned. And today she is very, very angry and very, very beautiful and very, very capable and so very alive. Recently we saw how Kate was arrested while drawing on the curb during the presidential motorcade. Well, she wasn't arrested. They attempted to arrest her. She punched the policeman and the policewoman and got away into the crowd, into the night. Well, that same night that she got into the fight with the police after she escaped and then was on the 10 o'clock news, she went to the bookstore to meet the friends who were supposed to have met her at the presidential parade. She walked fast through the crowd. She licked a cut lip, squeezed out her fear into her guitar case handle, weaved in and out, around, sweating, smiling wide. She grabbed the door handle for requisite books, cafe, and gifts, and held it for two white-haired professor types, then followed them. Kate spotted her friends across the room, seated around a table in classical fiction. She smelled expensive coffee and wood smoke from the fireplace in the geezers section. Kate's tennis shoes squeaked her across the shined hardwood floor. The rest of the quixotic quad began to move books and bags and coffee and croissants out of the way, clearing a space. Kate sipped from someone's coffee, then gave it back. "I socked a cop," she said.
The three stared at her with wry smiles, waiting for the punchline. Kate lowered her head and shoulders, looked around the table like a conniving blackjack dealer, and hissed, "I'm serious. I hit a policeman, too, just now, more than once." She looked at her hands, then back at the door. "Why?" asked one of the quad. Someone dabbed Kate's lip with a napkin. Another grabbed Kate's hands from across the little round table. She held them by the thumbs, palms down. "My God!" The three stared in horror at Kate's ragged knuckles. Kate found another napkin and rubbed her hands, wiping, applying direct pressure under the table. "Why?" a friend asked. "At the parade," said Kate. "Where were you?" He darted looks around. One said, "Why, I had karate class, of course. Where were you?" "Nobody called. Oh, I just woke up. I worked last night." "You were supposed to meet me." "What happened? You go to jail?" "No," said Kate, casting a glance at the door.
She grabbed a red drink from the middle of the table and slurped long from the straw. "Not yet," Kate smiled, then drank again. "Shh!" They all hissed, leaning toward her. Kate noticed a woman up in the coffee bar with a TV behind her shoulder, looking at her with a cell phone pressed into her ear. The woman looked away toward the TV. Kate sat straight, pushed her cap up, then looked around the table again. "We were going to tell them about 9/11, she said. "Shh," they said. They looked down, away, drank from their coffee, coke. The flight controllers lost 175 for an instant. They switched the old plane, and the passengers went somewhere. The new plane was a drone remote control. And Building 7, we know, Kate. Shh. I can't believe you, said Kate. You know what they did.
A friend took Kate's arm. We all know what they did to you, your family. Maybe this is all about that. He looked around at the others. Kate snatched her arm away. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a cell phone woman again looking her way. She looked at her friends with her mouth wrenched, hate in her eyes, shooting lasers. They had no idea, no guts. After all the late-night talks, all they really wanted was talk. To save themselves, someday they'd be sitting in a liberal bookstore in the university district, drinking orange latte mocha and dialing the police. Cold from the open front door grabbed Kate by the shoulder and turned her around. The policeman and woman she'd fought on TV stood in the front doorway by the new nonfiction carousel. Each held a revolver in one hand and a short black bat in the other, dangling. The woman tapped her leg with the bat as she surveyed the room. The man touched a fat lip with the barrel of his gun.
Kate turned back to her friends. Don't look, talk, she said. Is that them? The police officers you attacked? Kate shot green eyeball lasers all around that said plainly she did not attack any police officers. One of Kate's friends tried gamely to make this work. Well, what about this coffee? Good, huh? The others looked at her to dismiss her, and then back at Kate, and over her square shoulders at the police, and behind them in the parking lot, flashing lights and the glint of more guns and badges. They were right, Kate thought. It was about her parents. She wanted revenge, and she'd gotten a salty taste by smashing that woman's head into the bricks and her fists into her partner's teeth. It was all connected, her parents, 9/11, RFK, and not by a memo, a confession tape, a bloody shoe print, but by fabric, inertia, membranes, momentum. They will kill me now, she thought, looking at the terrified eyes of her friends, up at cell phone bitch, now drinking and enjoying her conversation with her friend across the table. Kate shoved her chair backward away from the table. She slapped her hands flat on her legs and pushed to stand. The bookstore background tune switched to the good, the bad, and the ugly. She looked each of her friends in the eyes, then turned to face the music. Keeping watch on the two cops, Kate moved her chair out of the way with a red tennis shoe. It squeaked. Kate stood straight, still her eyes locked on them, swinging their guns and batons. She smiled at them. She turned away. She tugged on the table, trying to pick it up. She imagined hurling the table at the charging man and woman. With one arm, she swiped the books and drinks and papers and bags from the table. She picked it up and threw it like a toy at the charging police. It knocked them to the floor, to their backs, hitting their heads on the shiny hardwood, sending their guns and badges and batons clattering, spinning away. Kate reached back for her guitar case. Adios, amigas, she smiled. She leaped between the two cops, vaulting off the table, flying through the air. Kate flying, she hit the floor running.
Kate looked around the table at her friends with shocked looks on their faces. One of the duties of the revolutionary, she whispered, is to get away with it. Like a professional hitman on just another day at the job, she picked up her guitar case and walked into history. Turned left at biography. Kept going, straight through discount hardcover. Kate slowed at the glass door exit as a flood of officers tried to get through the entrance door at once. Kate King walks past the police officers and cars, flashing lights and SUVs covering the parking lot. She moved away from the squawking radios. She waited at the light at the corner, holding a guitar case. On green, She adjusted her cap down and crossed the wide avenue into the night.
And that's the news from Mount Liberty, where all the soldiers are thugs, all the Democrats are cowards, and all the Homeland Security COINTELPRO high school football referees are about average.
We thank you for joining us tonight for another episode of the New American Dream Radio Show. We hope you'll be back same time, same place next week. We'd like to thank all those who sponsor our show, worldnewstrust.com, June2508.com, and I'd like to thank Mike, my co-host. Thanks, Mike, and have a good night.
Good night, Chuck. Stay warm. And good night, Mrs. Calabash. Good night, Todd Beamer. And good night, Barbara Olson, wherever you are.
Oh.